Sure.
Chris, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a Canadian. I live in Toronto. I make a living as an engineer. I have a small design and analysis firm, and we help people develop products, machines, all kinds of stuff. I guess as part of perhaps a midlife crisis, I went to seminary.
It's probably more expensive than the red sports car.
Oh, I got one too. Just to cover the bases, you know? But was more expensive, you're right. I went to seminary at a small seminary here in Toronto called Tyndale and took an MTS, a Master's of Theological Studies. So I'm married. We now have an empty nest. We were foster parents, as well as I had a couple kids, a couple stepchildren from my wife. So we were foster parents for many, many years. So that's really formative for me in many ways. What else? I grew up a Christian. Probably my earliest memories of, I don't remember not being a Christian. Okay. Sort of grew up in, I guess, in the 70s. My parents were really involved in the charismatic movement, and we shipped all over Ontario going to like the Mennonite Charismatic Conference.
Oh, fascinating.
All kinds of, oh yeah. So pretty varied church background. When I was 12, I think our family became Catholic, so we were
Wow,
baptized.
charismatic Mennonites to Roman Catholic.
Oh, we weren't Mennonites. We just went to the charismatic conference. No,
So you've had a very diverse feasting on Christianity.
yeah, I think so. I think so, and most of it great. You know, obviously not every church experience has been spectacular. And so I don't know, what am I missing out of components of what makes a person?
No,
That's
that's cool.
kind of
That's
what I
cool.
do.
Keep
So I,
talking.
yeah. So I guess the engineering part of my life will become important in the conversation eventually. So it's the work I do is fairly heavy in analysis. And looking at how things actually function in the world. And that, I guess, coupled with taking some courses in seminary, and having an interest in philosophy from when I went through my original bachelor's degree many years ago, and doing some reading, just had kind of combined in my head at some point a couple of years ago. Oh, yeah. And I mean, I grew up when you talk about reading Lord of the Rings for the first time. I think I was in grade 8 and started reading it and finished it in a weekend. And oh man, I loved it. I read it religiously once a year from then until when the movies came out. And not that I didn't enjoy the movies, but
I
I
know.
think of, I had to break from reading because it's the movie images are all in my head. And I'm going, where are the images I grew up with? You know? Anyway, I also grew up reading C.S. Lewis right through. I think I remember someone in a conversation I caught part of you having, someone mentioned the Space Trilogy.
Luke really loves the space trilogy.
Oh, as do I. I think. Have you touched it yet? Probably.
I read the Space Trilogy when I was in high school. That was too young. I need to read it again. And I think I'm gonna on this. I got a lot of playing hours ahead of me. Maybe I'll load it up.
Yeah, I think you can get it on Kindle pretty easily.
Kindle and Audible. So I'll load
Right.
Audible.
I think that the second book, Paralandra, is just gorgeous. It is just beautiful. Both in terms of just a picture of a new Garden of Eden,
Mm-hmm.
And what Lewis does with that in terms of temptation, and it's just beautiful.
Well, I'm going to have to load it all up. Still trying to figure out what I have to do some prep for my talks in Melbourne yet. I'm still trying to say that name right. But but on the way back, my son and I, one of my sons is going to be with me in Melbourne. He's also an engineer. He wanted to be a mechanical engineer, but then moved to Sacramento and got a job doing civil engineering. So
Right. He's probably better off. I think they generally get paid better.
Oh, I'll tell him.
It depends what industry, probably.
Yeah.
So actually, I forgot that one other rather important element of my life is for, I guess, it's going on 13 years now, my wife and I have been involved in missions in Cuba.
Oh.
So my going back to seminary was a little bit tongue-in-cheek as a midlife crisis. Not entirely, but you know.
Yeah.
So we've been involved with a group down there and go down 3 or 4 times a year, support them, influence what they're doing, guide, you know, and we just fell in love with the people, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. the couple that run the ministry we're involved with, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. so many people. And it's been really, really meaningful. In fact, I think when I was going through a really dry period before we met them in mm-hmm. my Christian walk, mm-hmm. You know, warn your son that engineering may grind.
It's going to be interesting because he does like other things like you do, like literature. He's right now his starting job. He has a fair amount of free headspace, so he's doing Dostoevsky right now. Solzhenitsyn, and so he's been with me with the meetups in Sacramento, and when my wife couldn't get the time off for school, so we're going for a little bit ahead of time. We're doing some touring in Australia because why fly around the world and not see stuff? And then she's flying back with the rest of the kids. So then my son is staying, but he's been into the Peterson stuff, so he'll really enjoy our time in Melbourne.
Wonderful. So I was really captivated by not at first, but by Peterson. Not at first, but eventually I caught this this whiff of sort of reconnecting worlds as you were describing it.
Yes.
And I had no idea that that's what it was at the beginning. And maybe I didn't have any idea until you laid it out so nicely, which I really appreciate. That's when I basically started listening to you, I think, more carefully than when it just happened to pop up on YouTube. And I love that. And partly because I think growing up Christian, you don't you can maintain a faith, right? Especially at least from my perspective, the time in which I grew up, which wasn't too different from yours, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you were a young Christian, there wasn't quite the same society hadn't fully agreed that evolution was true.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was still kind of questioned in the air, at least in the circles I was in, mm-hmm. even in the university, mm-hmm. right? And so you grow up reading like creationism books and things that people have around in church circles. And then it sort of like begins to creep in on you that, no, this is pretty, pretty substantive,
mm-hmm.
right? And so then the world kind of, your own world divides a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And mine was held together principally by, you know, just my relationship with God
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
directly,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And having that fairly strong charismatic background, that's mm-hmm. natural.
You had a lot of God number two.
A lot of God number two, that's right. Yep. But anyway, so then when Peterson starts talking like he does, I'm like, oh, this is completely new. This kind of like finding a rational path, if you will, back to God.
Yep.
But I was also interested in it because I had had this moment where I realized, oh, maybe the world's not divided in that way, but from a completely different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, I guess, I could start talking about that.
Sure.
If you like.
Yeah, well,
do you have any
go
questions
ahead.
As I go?
Yeah, go. Keep going. You're doing great.
All right. So I had read, during seminary, I had read, not for seminary, but I had read Chesterton's Orthodoxy.
Mm.
I think a professor mentioned it. And it's not like I had all kinds of extra time when I was like trying to run a company and go through seminary. But I read it.
Yep.
And I was first of all, the first time I read it, I did not understand it. I mean, I understood it in some ways, but I didn't understand And actually, to this day, I don't fully understand all the implications of what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I read it again, and I think I'm up to about five times through it. It's not that big a book anyway. But I found it utterly captivating, because he talks about basically that transcendence is foundational, and that we make sense of the world by making transcendence foundational. And if you try to make the rational foundational and flatten everything, like you were talking about, I think you were talking about, you did a word study on explanatory.
Yeah.
It flattens everything.
Yeah.
That's right. That it makes everything mystical, that you can't understand a thing at the end of the day. And he's you know, Chesterton's a little bit... there's lots of rhetoric.
A little snarky. He loves the snark.
Oh, yeah. So he's poking at the whole, like, skeptical history philosophy there, right? Yep. But it rings true. It rang true to me, but I didn't really understand the implications. So this is, like, sort of churning in the back of my head.
Yep.
And then late one night, for some reason, it's kind of just turning over in the back of my head. And I realize... all of a sudden, that calculus, which is the math, that's central to engineering.
Yeah.
In fact, it's central to almost all modern technology. Like, it enables everything that I do, and most sciences, at least all the physical sciences.
Mm-hmm.
That calculus actually has the same form that Chesterton is describing.
Really?
Yeah. So. Unlike, I know it's all called a math in the same way that, like, geometry or algebra or these things are called a math, but it's actually completely different, except that it uses numbers. and you use it to calculate things. But, you know, geometry starts from a rational basis, right? Like, you start with a circle, a line, and then you make conclusions out of that, and they're all deductive.
Yep. Yeah, we had that. Did you see the conversation I did with Eric on Euclid?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So you know, it was a Euclidean world.
Yeah.
During like the Renaissance.
Yeah.
Right? It was a Euclidean worldview.
Yeah.
Largely. I think people could pick away at, say, that Aquinas wasn't wholly that, for sure. Right?
Yeah.
That's the way they did math. And it was and math and philosophy and theology, they were all connected, right?
Mm-hmm.
So along comes a bunch of Italian mathematicians in the 15th century. If I got that wrong, but anyway,
yeah.
In the 15th century, and they start doing calculations using something called infinitesimals. And infinitesimal, the word itself is a paradox, because it's infinitely small, but it's something.
Yes.
And first of all, the Jesuits wanted to have nothing to do with it. And they suppressed it.
Huh.
In Italy.
Huh.
Largely. Now, and this is all, there's a larger history of this. And there's basically when this idea occurred to me, I went looking for has someone written about this? Where is this?
Right.
Where is this refuted?
Right.
Right? Or why am I wrong or am I right? And I'm just using a different words to describe it. So I looked and looked, can't really find much. A friend of mine said that this is what Kant was talking about, but I had a shot at Kant and I don't know.
Yeah.
Not quite there. I understand some of the edges of it. Anyway, I came upon this book called Infinitesimals, which was written like, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And it's a history of this math. And that's where I get this bit about the Jesuits suppressing it, et cetera, et cetera. And Galileo's mixed up in this.
How do you spell it? I'm trying to look it up on Amazon.
Oh, let me. So it's like infinite.
Okay.
And then S-I-M-A-L. And the author is Amir Alexander. So it's pretty well written, fairly accessible if you don't know much about math, even. So these people are like a generation before, like Newton, who formalized calculus, and Leibniz, who did it in parallel, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're basically the fathers of what we use as modern calculus today. But these people a generation before were in the middle of this fight.
Huh.
In Italy and in England. So the book is fascinating because he tells you all this. He knits together the politics of the day, the philosophy of the day, the battles, because the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah.
Right? So this is why the Jesuits were trying to control things.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating, fascinating history. And so, you know, I went looking to see where this idea I had cropped up, and I went, oh, this isn't just a fun, beautiful idea in my head. This is actually like fundamental to Western history and history of technology. So the other part of that book, and if I'm going on too long about this.
No, keep going. I'm hooked, baby.
All right, awesome. Well, I'm hooked. It's been like 2 years of me rolling around with this and reading and looking and whatever. But the second half of this book talks about Hobbes and an English mathematician, John Wallis, who had like a decades-long battle. So John Wallis was one of the first founding members of the Royal Society of Science in England. And he was using this infinitesimal math. And Hobbes, because Hobbes had kind of a, like Leviathan, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's like a full control, a Euclidean view, if you will.
Yeah.
Hobbes almost broke his, almost broke his head trying to square the circle, which is this mathematical thing that
people
can do, right? By Euclidean geometry, you can't make a circle. Anyway, you can look it up. And they had this long back and forth battle because it was so important to Hobbes and his philosophy and trying to maintain the world. And anyway, the author, Amir Alexander, does a brilliant job of contextualizing all this in the midst of the Protestant Reformation, the problems in England, the overflow of overthrow of the king that happened somewhere in that period.
How many books can I read on this flight to Australia? I mean, you're keep going. This is amazing.
So anyway, that's enough, right? Of that history, like as far as I think to make the point that the birth of this math was, it was like a cataclysm in how science, math was done. And I think it's hugely underreported. Because partly it drove people nuts that you can't prove that it works. Like you can't prove it back to first principles.
Right. Like you can Euclid.
Of course, yeah. Euclid or algebra or any other, right?
Right.
You can't go back. And in modern math, if there's mathematicians listening to this eventually, they'll say, oh no, that there's this other like sort of roundabout proof in the 20th century or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But certainly at the time, it was justified because it worked. And what it enabled people to do was actually model the actual world.
Right.
Which is different. Right? It's
right.
Philosophically different
right.
from imposing geometry
right.
on the world, to speak roughly.
Right.
So, I haven't done enough reading to chase this down, but it's my suspicion that part of the strength of, oh, I've slipped the word. when you measure something and therefore it's true, it's the philosophical term is like, or it's every scientist talks about it, like it's reason and...
Empiricism. Yeah.
Part of the, like, people before this period, of course people looked at what worked and what didn't and changed what they were doing accordingly.
Sure.
But empiricism had no philosophical teeth.
Right.
I think that this acceptance of calculus, of this calculation by infinitesimals, gave empiricism philosophical teeth in the context of the 17th century when it really came to the fore.
Wow.
Because it says that you can't prove that it worked. You can't prove from first principles that it is, but it works. Therefore, depending on who's saying it, therefore it's true, therefore it's good enough for us, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating.
So then if I start saying to myself, if that's how the physical world is, if that's how we apprehend the physical world, at least.
Yeah.
But that's how we model. That's the form of the physical world. And that also works according to Chesterton in the psychological world and in the way we communicate, the way we are. It's a universal principle. It's the nature of the world. That transcendence actually underpins everything. And I thought, okay, well, I just leapt over. I didn't have the word divided world at the time, I had the sensibility about it.
Right.
Maybe I've just stepped over the divide here or changed the viewpoint to a point where the world isn't divided when viewed in this way.
Wow. So how has this affected you? Because we have an engineer and a pastor talking about math and theology and philosophy. I mean, there's, you know, mathematicians and theologians and philosophers are going to be chafing.
Sure.
Those practitioners, they always run fast and loose with the theory. That might work in reality, but it doesn't work in theory.
In theory, that's right. I know, right? Isn't that what the French engineers say? I always say that's the quote, right?
That's right.
But isn't that the fact? I mean, well, anyway. engineering is applied science.
Yeah.
So that's, in fact, the name of my degree was applied science.
Yeah.
So yeah. I have no trouble saying that I like it applied to the real world. So then as I've gone on, taking that as like my starting point now,
I
thought, okay, so maybe this is actually a more fundamental idea, not just a happy coincidence that seems like, it seems like the incarnation is not an interruption in the world.
Right.
But it's foundational. Certainly foundational to Christianity.
Right. The you know, for me, this whole Peterson journey, which is, and I always, you know, I phrase it that way because it's not just Peterson, it's all of you. It's the people, it's the conversations we're having right now. You know, this just really helped me at a deeper level, you know, flip the world in terms of, you know, just like you expressed, and see it and more easily. We don't appreciate the degree to which we are formed by that which we are not paying attention to. And so, the, you know, a number of years ago, I just felt boy, there's just way too much. There's just way too much materialism in my soul. What do I need to do with that? Because if that starts taking over the consciousness congress, things could get ugly. And so then, I had read Lewis all my life, but I had never read Miracles, and I read his book Miracles, and that just kind of a whole bunch of stuff that had just kind of gone past the checkpoint. Lewis then was the cop and said, "Now wait a minute, let's examine these credentials." But another piece that for me has been interesting is that, right in that late medieval period into the early modern period, a lot of stuff happened, much of which we know hardly anything about, just like what you just explained to me. I knew nothing about that, nothing. Nope. And we're both practitioners, we're not academics. We're reasonably educated, well-educated people. I mean, I was, before I got a degree in history, I was kind of thinking about getting a degree in math until I got into abstract algebra and realized, that was it for me and my math major, abstract algebra. I got a B in the class, but I was looking around at other people getting A's. I thought, they're mathematicians. I'm not. Nope. So, but there, and the Protestant Reformation is in this in a lot of interesting ways. And of course, I was educated in it, and anyone in the kind of Christian education I received, just kind of a shallow, politicized, weaponized, anti-Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these deeper roots. So on one hand, from the Protestant side, it's really important to recognize the Catholicity of the Reformers, something which is really coming to the fore now in a lot of Protestants. On the Catholic side, there's something to be said. The Reformation happened for a reason. And you really have to work on figuring out what that reason is, because it's way more than just corruption of the priesthood and some of those are expressions of. So anyway. So really interesting.
No, I'm with you there. And I have done so much, because it really challenged me going through seminary because I'm a Protestant. I know I was Catholic, baptized and confirmed, but as an adult, I've gone to Mass a few times because I actually really like it. Generally, I've been in Protestant churches. My wife and I have ended up now at a Anglican church in Toronto.
The Anglicans. It's so funny because so many Protestants that are kind of at this front edge become wistful Anglicans now, but but they're still divided by the main culture war divide that we see happening. Mm-hmm. And I mean, because if there's any place that this culture war divide is fierce, it's amongst the Episcopalians and the Anglicans, because
it's a smaller Anglican church in Toronto.
Yeah,
beautiful place, great preaching. I love the liturgy. It's a tone, it's a simplified liturgy compared to the Catholic Church. But this church has so many ex-evangelicals.
Yeah, yeah.
Of which I would count myself that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the culture divide just within the congregation is substantial.
Yeah.
In terms of politics, degree of belief, all those things, right? Yeah. Like there's no getting, because when you're new to a church, which we still are kind of, it's a couple of years.
Yeah.
You try to get a read on what? Yeah. What can I say? What can I say?
That's all right, those right. things. What will I lose status by admitting in this place?
Right. Well, that's all complicated. But you asked me what it's done for me. First of all, I was transfixed with joy when the idea first occurred to me.
Wow.
Oh yeah, I was sitting up, and my wife came in because actually, to tell you the truth, I snore, so I was supposed to be sleeping in another room. I wasn't sleeping. My wife came in, and I'm like, just so happy. And she said, "How are you doing?" I said, "I'm wonderful." I said, "Can you guess what I'm thinking about?" And she says, "Oh, what?" Because, well, you know.
Me? Are you thinking about me? No, honey.
No.
Philosophers.
No, I said, I'm thinking about calculus. And Jesus. And so she loves telling that story. Because. But that was the truth of it. Because I was like, So in a sense, I'm meeting Christ in the midst of my work, yeah. in the midst of the math that underpins my work, at least.
Yeah.
And it did reconnect the landscape of my world.
Yeah.
So that, you know, yeah. I guess. In some ways, I think about St. Patrick's. Was it St. Patrick's Shield? No. Have you ever read St. Patrick's Prayer?
No.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's called St. Patrick's Shield. It's like, you know, it's basically a poem, you know, five stanzas long. But the second to last stanza, he goes on as Christ before me, Christ behind me.
St. Patrick's breastplate.
Breastplate, thank you. Yeah. Anyway, he goes on with like Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ to the right of me, right, Christ to the left of me. Mm-hmm. Christ above
Christ,
me.
Christ in me, Christ beneath me, Christ above right. me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, when I lie down, when I sit down, when I arise. In the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks of me, Christ in every eye that sees me, Christ in every ear that hears me. I rise today through a mighty strength, the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession in the oneness of the Creator of creation. Wow.
Yeah. No, it's so beautiful. So I guess in some senses, that's what it did for me, is rather than my Christianity being like this kind of like tunnel relationship in my worldview, it reestablished it as my world.
So God number one and God number two came together.
Yeah, fully. That's right. Yeah, I think so.
The division was eliminated.
I think that's right. So, should I go on?
Yes, by all means.
All right. So I was really, I listened to your conversation with, is it Cord?
Yes. Cord yesterday.
Yeah. And actually I put something in the comment section to him. And he responded. It was really nice. But he was talking about, the mapping the world as like with, yeah. And in the comment section, because it's exactly what I've been thinking about, as a way to kind of picture how we look at the world. I've been thinking about the asymptote. So you remember your math?
No.
So an asymptote is where, you know, you're going along a number line and then you hit infinity. And the curve goes up.
Yep.
Never reaches, but
yep.
Right?
Yep.
So
yep.
It's approaching this limit.
Yep.
Right? So that's an asymptote.
Yep. Okay.
So whenever I hear, in fact, whenever I hear Peterson talking about going up a hill or any talk of enlightenment, I think it's nice that we have a picture of a mountain, but I don't think there's a top. Mm-hmm. Or put differently, God's at the top, and so you can never reach there.
Mm-hmm. It's that someone pulled out. Oh, it was Rick, my friend who gave me this, pulled out the dollar bill the other side, said, you know, showed the triangle, but the eyes above the triangle, it's the asymptote. You don't actually get to this all seeing eye on top of the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good.
And so the implications, if you start using that as a lens through which you see these things, and that's what I've been trying to do.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I have more, I understand Calvinism a little bit better.
Whereas, yeah.
And actually, I think it has, looking at it that way, I think it has maybe the possibility of unifying the two views.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
because, mm-hmm. Of course, I can agree with, and I don't know Calvinist theology very well, and I guess you could tell I'm not one.
Plenty of Anglicans were Calvinists.
No, it's true. It's a funny mix, right?
Yep.
But actually, as a sidebar, what I find delightful about the Anglican Church is it's not formed and identified based on theology.
Yeah.
Right? It's identified based on practice.
Yeah.
Which if someone had told me that as a positive 15 years ago, I'd be like,
Or we might argue Anglicanism is identified based on a language, which is English.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Because it's a state church. What's interesting about state churches are that they see, this is where the Christian Reformed Church as opposed to the RCA, because there's the split in the Netherlands Church. Mm-hmm. So the Christian Reformed Church is the descendant of the free church, not the state church. But yet, because of its Dutchness, it was at least for a while in the United States joined by a language. And I would imagine Anglicanism, it's a state church. And so you're going to have theological division within it.
Yeah.
Unlike a confessional church, which says we are defined by our theology. The difficulty that you have is that the theological stream keeps moving and the confession tends to ossify. And that's in a sense what's happened with the Dutch Reformed churches. And that leads to a whole bunch of things that we don't have to get into. But your point is really well made. I mean, Calvinism comes along. Each theological tradition, so here's Richard Foster's lovely little book, Streams of Living Water, you'd appreciate this book given how you grew up. Because basically what this book goes into is the different traditions make their contributions.
Ah, yeah. And, so maybe I've read some excerpts out of that.
Yeah, you could have.
Yeah.
Tim Keller has this fascinating idea that when revival happens, now that's a word you have to use with a little bit of discernment in America, because it tends to be associated with tents and sawdust and camp meetings. But Tim Keller's definition of revival are these moments in the church where it's like the church hits nitrous oxide and boom. Like early 20th century Korean revival. There've been revivals in different places throughout the history of the church, not just the Protestant churches, but throughout the history of the church. And one of the things that Tim Keller noted is that all of, in a sense, what happens when revival hits is that all of the streams come together. The church, in other words, it's kind of like Voltron. You know, you have these separate lions, and most of the time the lions are just kind of out there doing their old thing, and the lions have their different emphases, but it's when all the lions come together, that's when revival happens. The thing is, we can't make revival happen. Revival, again, is always a gift, and so I love your imagery of the, I can't say the word, because math has been 30 years ago.
The asymptote.
You can't actually climb that line to get to infinity. You just keep climbing. You won't actually get there. So theoretically, there's a gap, and that's between the pyramid and the eye on top on the back of the dollar.
Right.
And so it always comes down, and that's what Calvinism emphasizes, is that gap.
Yep.
That finally we can't bridge the gap. That's the heart of Calvinism, I think, really.
No, and I can't disagree with that, obviously. Some of the hard kind of rationalized doctrine, I don't think, well, I can't.
It's Calvinist scholasticism, and a lot of Calvinists kind of like, some really love it, others kind of cringe.
Yeah, fair enough. But I think that idea of kind of get up to the top is almost like, and not reaching it, it's like a human universal. So I began looking around for this, and then I've got a quote by a jazz musician. Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
No jazz musician quotes on my channel.
That's right. Sorry, I'm Canadian. If I'm not up talking or apologizing, I don't know what to do. So Sonny Rollins is a saxophone player. In the 60s. I don't know his stuff that well. So, but he was being interviewed on our national broadcaster about, and the interviewer was asking him about, like, there was like, he took a couple breaks during playing, at the height of his playing, to practice for a year and not make any money. So he's asking him this. And Sonny Rollins responds with, why? Why? Why is because I am such an incomplete player. I am really a guy that knows I should be playing more. So I know there is more, and I need to get to that more place. So I love to practice, and I am practicing to get to that place. And then he says, the interviewer, can you get there? Is it possible to get to the end, or is that like pushing the boulder up the hill? And Rollins responds, right, it may be. It may be like that. But you know, each step further you take, you see more. It's like a vista. You might never get there. Every step you push the ball up, there is more exposed there for you to see. So it's a beautiful trip. And for me, I just thought that was just gorgeous.
That's really helping me in, so lately I've been thinking a lot about, so you've got chaos and order. You've got the vision in the book of Revelation where there's no longer any sea. And of course that bothers people who love the ocean. Because like, oh, why would God take the ocean away? No, that's not the point. Listen to Jonathan Peugeot. It's symbolic. But you get, one of my favorite ideas from C.S. Lewis is from The Last Battle, further up and further in.
Yeah.
And with what you've just talked about, because then you wonder, well, if there's all of it, if there's all of eternity, when we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, there's no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. So if we have all of eternity, won't we exhaust God? And the answer is no.
No.
Oh, take that materialism someplace else, please, because I have no patience for it, because this is just too good.
No. Absolutely. And will we even exhaust each other?
Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
So that's just the most beautiful thing that has come. Actually, how did it affect me? That's come out of this for me. Yeah. Is it's kind of, so we can have this conversation, right? And the conversation is rational,
yes.
Right? The basis for the conversation, the way we converse, right?
Yes.
The way we, argue or agree or make points, or we're, that's the way we work as a society, right?
Yep.
It's impossible without it.
Yep.
So, when the new atheist, or really anyone, is demanding that we be rational, that everything be rational, like, there's a reason for that, right?
Yes. Yes.
Because without it, political, union, like society doesn't function.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
But when they try to flatten people.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Right?
Yep.
When they try to flatten people.
Yep.
They don't recognize that there's a boundary there. Right. Like, and that was actually, that is Kant. That's a little bit I understand from reading, not Kant, but people interpreting him.
Okay.
That's Kant saying, well, you have to make this transcendental deduction in order to have anything worthwhile. He uses that to develop his, I forget the term for it, but his moral system. right? Mm-hmm. Which is basically the golden rule,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the picture I have is that when we're talking, we're like two asymptotes that have like fabric between us.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand more and more about you through rational means, mm-hmm. and climb. So that's rationality, climbing up mm-hmm. the hill mm-hmm. of who you are. And I can use my wife as an example if you're more comfortable with that. But, you know, like...
I'm not uncomfortable. I'm a very not uncomfortable guy if you haven't picked that up yet.
Yeah. But that's what we explore one another, and we never exhaust that.
Right.
And you're right, Lewis. I had forgotten that that's in our last battle. It's okay. Also at the end of Paralandra.
Oh, really?
In the... Yeah.
Oh, boy. See, I can't read five books. I always try to read five books at once.
No pressure from me. No pressure.
Pressure from you. It's pressure from me.
Yeah. but all of a sudden, if you... I guess the picture I have of this reality is like the reality that we apprehend rationally,
mm-hmm.
is like a large, you know, multi-pole tent,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and thousands of poles, right? And the right. fabric
right.
is stretched between them everywhere.
Right.
And that's us navigating this world that's supported by transcendence.
Yep.
Yep. At every pole.
Yep. Well, the poles, you know, often with the tent, the pole ends at the tent. In this case, the poles just keep going.
Right. Yeah. And so I actually think in some ways that's an explanation for postmodernism. Because I think when you demolish transcendence in your worldview, then what is actually transcendent begins to appear as complexity, simply. And it's almost unnavigable complexity.
Well, but this is something I figured out a few months ago when, yeah. so Darwin, so when you listen to people like the celebrity atheists knocking around, you know, well, random. It's not God, it's random. And then paused, I said, well, what is random? And you start digging into it. What random is complexity. It's complexity beyond what we can fathom or, yeah. more importantly, colonize. And so you've just taken that word and substituted it for God and said, but not God. And when I hear that, I hear, yeah, you're just scared, and rightfully so. You really don't want someone else. That this is where the Calvinist comes out in me. You really don't want someone else choosing your destiny, do you? And so it's willful denial is what it is, which is exactly what Paul says in Romans 1. What is our problem? We suppress the truth with our hearts. It's willful denial. Because that it's we are terrified by the idea that, you know, that someone else is choosing, and we are at the tail end of this story, and we don't have a lick of control.
Mm-hmm.
We really, and so now who's telling each other a convenient story, Mr. Atheist? I'm ready to be out here and say, no, I don't have a lick of control here. And I'm emotionally okay with that. And yeah, my religion is helping me with that. Absolutely. What's helping you? Lies? So when you look at postmodernity, then you basically have taken that idea of random and institutionalized it and made it pervasive.
Yeah.
In order to, and I think Peterson is right on this. So yeah, none of us are in control. So why don't you let me be in control?
Oh my goodness.
Oh, that's really good. That's really helpful. No, that's real. Because that was driving me crazy out here. Well, it's random selection. Okay. Well, pause. Let's talk about this word random a little bit, because you don't see billiard balls being random if there's only eight of them on a table. That's because there's only eight. And when it comes to human behavior, there's just way too many forces to track, partly because the forces are historical and you don't have access to them because there's been no record of them. So you can't do the math.
Yeah. And where does Aristotle's formal cause come into this?
Well, and, you know, so when I started, so Strawn is this South African guy who he's blogging a little bit and tweeting a little bit now, but he jumped on me almost right away. And so he said, oh, you got to watch Verveke. And so then I was watching some of Verveke stuff, and Verveke kind of nicely lays out Aristotle. And I never really understood Aristotle's formal cause until Verveke laid it out. And I thought, oh, okay. So if you look at Peugeot, and you say, okay, the patterns, Peugeot and Peterson and their patterns, you look at Peugeot and Peterson and their patterns, at some point you have to say, well, where do the patterns come from? Now, a materialist might press hard and say, well, if in fact we knew enough, we would, and this therefore is their argument of faith, it would be built into physics. And so then it's like, okay, well, where do the patterns in physics come from? I mean,
no, but we're back, at least in my head, we're back to my initial revelation that
that's right.
That it's built on transcendence.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, part of the new atheists or any atheist's strength of argument is that look at what all science has done for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And part of, I guess my point now is that without calculus, without this dependence on the transcendent, without approaching the world like that, you don't have cell phones, you don't have cars, you don't have airplanes, you don't have rockets. You might not even have very good steam engines. You don't have modern buildings. You don't have much in modern technology without depending on the transcendent. So enough with the only rational.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Enough with that.
Yeah. Well, and this is, you know, this is part of the correlation with McGilchrist and Jonathan Haidt in terms of the intuitive is the master and the rational is the emissary. The elephant is actually doing the moving. And the rider is telling just so stories to impress the other riders.
Right.
And then you say, well, where does the elephant come from? Or where does the intuitive come from? Well, that comes from random. Oh, okay. So just you don't know. And in fact, you're saying you can't know. So.
Yeah. I know. So. Two more things about that.
Okay.
That crossed my mind.
Okay.
Like science does do this work of climbing up the hill through rational public discussion. Because that's part of, and so they do get to, like, they do get to see more.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
They do, but I think if you use that image, that they never reach the top, right?
Right.
So they never close the gap.
Right.
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 So, you know, so the gap, use the God of the gaps phraseology, is the asymptote always. Mm. So they can, you know, so they can close sort of knowledge about you and me, about humans, about, you know, people made in the image of God, down to consciousness or down to whatever's left, but that is transcendent and it never closes. So the case they make that, oh, we're closing all the gaps. Okay, that's great. It's really good work.
You're closing gaps. You're not closing all of the gaps.
No.
And I think I love the way this is shaping up, because, you know, one of the things that I also noted with the celebrity atheist was their eschatology. Don't worry, we'll cure cancer. Good. When? After I'm dead of it, you know.
Yeah.
And given the rest of your worldview, you know, I'm screwed. You're not offering me anything. Oh, but no, all you have is your rationalist pride. That's what the whole game is about. And I look at that and I say, what's that? I don't care about that.
No.
That's really good.
So the other thing, I think you interviewed someone from Ontario, if I remember correctly, who had was exploring or was interested or had been practicing Buddhism.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least Buddhism. Okay. And he was making the point, I thought really beautifully, that Buddhism has this easy on-ramp.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so in my mind, what that says is, yeah, it really works in our common culture today because it starts in the rational realm. And it tries, and Buddhism works to, not that I know very much about Buddhism, but it appears to me like it starts in the rational realm and works towards transcendence.
Yes, yes. The Buddhism that has gotten popular in the secular West with secular atheist people.
Yeah.
With my secular atheist friends, usually.
Yeah, yeah.
So, because they say, oh, I don't need a metaphysic. This is simply pragmatic for helping me deal with the complexities and pains of life.
Yeah, absolutely. So when looked at that way, it's like it's an inversion of Christianity. Mm-hmm. So Christianity says you start by integrating the transcendent.
Yes. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord your God is one. It's like,
absolutely. Yeah.
You know, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God. You know, if you're an ancient Israelite, it's like, okay, so we're gonna it's gonna be this one that we follow instead of these. The Lord your God is one. It's like,
yeah. Absolutely. And even Christian practice, right? We're supposed to be empowered by the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So for me, there's a real mirror there to what I'm talking about, that the Holy Spirit helps us navigate the world.
Yeah.
But it's foundational. You're not approaching the Holy Spirit.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
It's the starting seed.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so it's an inversion. And it's like Chesterton was saying, that you start with mysticism, with this mystical, with the transcendent, with a little leap of faith.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was funny. I was explaining this calculus idea to people at work who are not, some are Christian, some are not.
Right.
And the person who one of the people I was explaining it to has absolutely zero church background. I don't no knowledge at all. And she said, "Oh, it's like a leap of faith." And so I said, "Yes, calculus is like an automation of leaps of faith. It's the systemization of this."
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
So that's what I've been working on and thinking about. And I was so delighted to hear everything you've been talking about and Peterson, because I've been kind of like, I don't know, in my spare time trying to write or whatever, right?
Yeah. This is really cool. This is really, really good. So you're going to let me post this, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm very happy to. I look forward to the criticism.
Good. Because I hate it when I have a conversation like this and the person's like, I can't really post this. I'm like, that you're robbing the world. You're robbing the world.
Well, Yeah, I mean, at some point, I've got to start engaging the world with the idea. So I started a little blog post to write about stuff, and I haven't written about this yet, but I needed to get, because it's complicated to write about.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and again, and this is where Peterson has been so helpful, because, you know, so what has Peterson done? And to me, what he's done is he kind of created a platform and a flag. Jordan Peterson became this flag, and all these people have kind of gathered around him, because this crazy Canadian from University of Toronto talked on all these different things in such an interesting way. And we all kind of gather here to like, what's going on with this guy? And all with different aspects. And so then, you know, I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day, and he's like, well, you should, it's too bad you don't have like hours to do like Joe Rogan. I said, yeah, but the thing is, you all are coming to me. And what's been so cool about this is I could never find you in any of this.
No, not a chance.
Find me.
Well, I have to say, I meant to say earlier, like off the top, that what you've been doing, I thought was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Because I watched the conversations you've had with people from all kinds of different points of view. And I saw you, like you've drawn me out. I've seen you just drawing people out, and it's really a beautiful work. And I don't know if I've ever seen anything quite like it. And, you know, and your combination of, you know, commitment to seeing the truth in things and drilling down, but also the humility to do that in conversation and publicly is quite beautiful.
Oh, it's been fun.
I'm just having fun, baby.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, this has been great. So I, you know, it's so bad because I'm so impulsive. So it's like, I got to post this one today, you know, so I probably will.
Oh, awesome. If you want, that's great. I don't think I've mentioned anything too personal.
No. I'll leave it alone. This was a delight, and folks are going to, you know, and again, the math connection with my channel has been so amazing. All these mathematicians and people interested in math. And I thought, I never would have pieced this together with math. But
no, because that's the thing that occurred to me. It's like, why did we stop connecting math, philosophy, and theology?
Yeah, yeah.
We're the modern culture is the only culture that's done that.
Yeah.
Right? You look at the Greeks, you look at the right through everything up till the end of the Renaissance. All part of a larger dialogue together.
Yeah.
For some reason, we like just use math.
Yeah. Yeah. Stop yeah. Being. Yeah. Oh, we're such rapists. You know, we just use math. You know, it's like, oh, we're terrible people. See, I'm a Calvinist. We're terrible people. We really are. All of us. Yeah. Without exception.
So before we go, can I mention my blog site?
Because yes, I have please do.
Just a couple short pieces on there that
email it to me too, so I can put it in the link.
Sure. It's humanetranscendence.com.
Humanetranscendence.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know about the name, but I thought it was good to kind of
sounds cool to me.
Bridge worlds a little bit.
So let's get you some traffic on your blog. This is awesome.
It's not monetized, but I like feedback.
And if you have some ideas for how I should entitle this, you know, throw those in the email too. So I've got a conversation right after this, some poor guy getting up in the middle of the night from Australia to talk to me. And then my next few days are just nuts. So I'm going to be off the grid for a while. But send me the email. Hopefully I'll get this posted right away. And I can't wait to see what happens with it. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you. Have a great trip.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.